Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, I'll run down how the right-wing bent of this Republican primary season isn't undone simply because the most moderate Republican in the field won Iowa. Jessica Valente comes on to explain the purity myth, and I say goodbye to Michelle Bachmann, who has bowed out of the race. Taking a break from all the sad and angry-making news, here's a cool little item from CNN.
Two brand new twin baby girls not only have different birthdays, they have different birth years. Jenna was born at 11:59 p.m. New Year's Eve, and her sister Leah was born at midnight in 2012.
It would be cool having a different birthday and birth year from your twin. I would insist that everyone sing happy birthday to both of us right at midnight. While it does seem that the nomination is almost surely going to go to Mitt Romney, that doesn't mean the past half year of nonstop Republican primary coverage was for nothing. The constant rise and fall of various right-wing candidates had an impact, pulling the nation's discourse to the right. You can track this in many different ways, but for the sake of this show, I'm going to talk about reproductive rights. I would argue that the ongoing coverage of far-right candidates has created a space for even more extremist anti-choice views to be aired in public and considered acceptable views. The danger in this, of course, is that once it becomes commonplace for people to denounce the birth control pill on TV, for instance, not only does that put the pill in more danger, but it makes opposition to abortion rights seem less extreme. We actually saw the culmination of this problem at the end of 2011, as I'll explain. But first, a rundown of things that candidates said during the heavy campaign season that I feel generally would have been more frowned upon in public even a year ago. First, the award to the most fantastical storytelling goes to Ron Paul for making this claim in an ad that he blanketed Iowa with.
I happened to walk into an operating room where they were doing an abortion on a late pregnancy. They lifted out a small baby that was able to cry and breathe, and they put a little bucket and put it in the corner of the room and pretended it wasn't there.
I'm going to say up front that I'm intensely skeptical of this story. You frequently hear anti-choicers trading stories like this, and they should be treated like you do stories about Satan putting messages in Queen records, or stories of Procter and Gamble working for Satan. The sort of blatantly untrue tall tales that right-wingers pass around, often realizing that they aren't true, but they like them anyway because it makes them feel self-righteous. It's worth noting that this story is incoherent when you apply the anti-choice philosophy to it, since they claim to believe that a single-celled fertilized egg is the same thing as a child, why focus on late-term abortion? It's no worse than an early one, in their view. Simply telling these stories suggests that they grasp that a woman who gets an 8-week abortion of choice isn't committing murder, and their claims to believe otherwise are disingenuous. That a blatant bit of urban legend creation got into a campaign ad endorsed by a candidate is startling enough, but his hostility to late-term abortion doesn't really move the dial to the right. The next quote probably did.
Well, I will tell you that I had a mother last night come up to me here in Tampa, Florida, after the debate. She told me that her little daughter took that vaccine, that injection, and she suffered from mental retardation thereafter.
This launched nearly a month of discussion about the HPV vaccine in the public discourse. That would have been fine, except that by doing that, this lie that the vaccine is dangerous got a lot of airing. And now it's probably going to be even harder to dislodge this myth from people's minds. Certainly, this helped make it easier for politicians of all stripes to make the argument in public that women's access to non-abortive reproductive health care should be restricted on the grounds that good, chaste girls don't need that stuff anyway. Rick Santorum particularly made a point of repeatedly attacking legal contraception on the campaign trail.
One of the things I will talk about that no president has talked about before is I think the dangers of contraception in this country. The whole sexual libertine idea. Many in the Christian faith have said, well, that's okay. I mean, you know, laws. Contraception's okay. It's not okay because it's a license to do things in the sexual realm that is counter to what how things are supposed to be. They're supposed to be within marriage. They're supposed to be for purposes that are, yes, conjugal, but also immunitive, but also procreative.
And in case that wasn't clear, he explained to Jake Tapper that he rejects the 1965 Supreme Court decision striking down state laws on contraception.
Out of the mainstream, and they talk about the Griswold versus Connecticut case. That was an issue that Casey used against you, about whether or not a state has the right to make a law against a married couple using contraceptives. Is that something you're at all concerned about?
The state has a right to do that. I've never questioned whether the state has the right to do that. It's not a constitutional right. The state has the law, has the right to pass whatever statutes they have, and that's the thing I've said about the activism of the Supreme Court.
He's trying to hedge a little and pretend that this is about some sort of strict view of the separation of powers, but as his previous comments show, he's actually just hostile to contraception. But I love how he phrases it. If you tease out what he's saying, he's basically saying the Supreme Court's power is illegitimate. If the state has an absolute right to pass any law at once, even those that are in strict violation of the Constitution, then what's the point of the Constitution? If they can't enforce the Constitution, they are basically pointless. I don't imagine Santorum thinks that's always true, so I have to assume he's hiding behind this to justify his hostility to contraception. It's easy to write all these things off as the words of cranks and also rounds, but unfortunately, the anti-choice pressure they're exerting has an impact on more mainstream politicians, and too open disdain for contraception and STD prevention was a factor in Barack Obama taking this stance on over-the-counter sales of Plan B.
I will say this, as the father of two daughters, I think it is important for us to make sure that we apply some common sense to various rules when it comes to over-the-counter medicine. And as I understand it, the reason Kathleen made this decision was she could not be confident that a 10-year-old or an 11-year-old going to a drugstore should be able, alongside bubble gum or batteries, be able to buy a medication that potentially, if not used properly, could end up having an adverse effect.
Since the drug is quite safe, the only factor in play here is the fear that girls under 17 could access contraception they can control without male cooperation. Like with Bachman claiming that the HPV vaccine is dangerous when it's not, Obama is simply using unevidenced fears about dangers as a cover for an attack on basic contraception rights. Since he is pro-choice, I suspect this is more a reflection of his campaign's fears going into this election than his actual beliefs. But the fact that you have more candidates going on TV and attacking non-abortion reproductive health care is probably why his political staff panicked and moved to the right on this. So even though Paul, Bachman, and Santorum have no chance of winning this race, their comments have left a mark. I'd like to introduce Jessica Valente to the program. Jessica is the founder of Feministine.com, an author of several books on feminism, and now the star of her own documentary titled The Purity Myth. It's about the growing enthusiasm in American culture for idealizing virginity and why that's bad for girls. Welcome to RealityCast, Jessica.
Thanks for having me on, Amanda. I like you describing me as the star of anything.
But you are the star. They show video clips and they go back to you and you explain them.
Sure. Narrator, star, I'll take either.
Okay, so this documentary is based on a book about the same general ideas, and the book's also called The Purity Myth. How did you manage to turn your book into a movie?
Well, it was actually kind of amazing. The folks at the Media Education Foundation, and they produce a lot of great films that probably your listeners would be familiar with. The Killing Me Softly series. They did Byron Hurt's Beyond Beats and Rhymes. They actually approached me about working together on a script and a documentary version of the book. And of course I jumped at the chance, to do it because they're pretty awesome and they do great work. So it was a lot of fun.
It's about 45 minutes long. How much work was that?
It wasn't, you know, it wasn't terrible. That, you know, writing the script was difficult because obviously to try to get, you know, a book's worth of information into a 45-minute film is incredibly difficult because the script really ends up, you know, just being a couple of pages at the end of the day. So what we really had to do is not obviously put the entire book into a movie, but kind of figure out what was the most pertinent information, what was the most current, what would be the most interesting to viewers. And a lot of these films, the films that the Media Education Foundation does, go to colleges. So it's mostly watched by students. That's why it's 45 minutes. So it's kind of perfectly tailored for a classroom. So we kind of thought of it that way. So the script was a good deal of work and kind of a long process, but we filmed it in one day, and that was terrific. But I shouldn't say that I know how much work it actually was because all of the clips, and the editing and everything like that was done by the Media Education Foundation.
So what is the purity myth exactly?
You know, I've always described it as the lie that women's sexuality has some bearing on who we are and how good we are. But in particular, what I try to explore in the book and in the film is the way that that lie kind of underlies and influences so much, you know, policy around women, social structures around women, and how ultimately it's a really damaging thing. With the film, what we tried to focus on was the way in which conservative politicians and evangelical Christians use the purity myth as a way to push kind of a broader, more regressive agenda for women.
See, and I think one thing that may confuse a lot of people, and I've certainly had this put to me a number of times by people, usually friendly criticisms, they think that there's actually more pressure on women to be sexualized and to be sexually active in our society and object to the notion that women are expected to be pure in any sense. What do you say to that?
I get that a lot. People are like, what do you mean, like, virginity? No one talks about virginity anymore. And it's, you know, it's all super hypersexualized. And I think that that's true. And I think that that's a fair point to bring up. But my point is that kind of the hypersexualization and the expectation of purity are two sides of the same coin, right? Like it's still a focus on women's sexuality as the ultimate marker of who she is as a person, whether that sexuality is considered promiscuous or is considered pure and virginal. And really when you look at kind of the way that the folks that I call the virginity movement are trying to push their wares, as I like to say, you know, they're propping up, you know, kind of virgins in pop culture. They're propping up these ideas through purity balls and abstinence only education. And they're saying that it's kind of the antidote or the alternative to our hypersexualized pop culture. But really, it's the same exact thing. You know, you can talk about girls' virginity, or when you talk about like Miley Cyrus being a virgin or whatever, you're still talking about their sexuality. When like you bring your 6-year-old to a purity ball, you're sexualizing her, even though you're claiming to do the opposite. So for me, they go hand in hand.
Well, and you really see that in the sort of like right wing obsession lately with the, what I call the sexy virgin.
Yeah. The sexy virgin. I mean, the sexy virgin has been around for a while, and yeah, it's kind of unbelievable that they haven't really picked up on how hypocritical and damaging that is, but maybe one day they will.
I don't know. I think they see it as something of a selling point. Like they specifically like seek out sexy virgins to give the abstinence only speeches and whatnot.
Yeah. Well, it's like the Jessica Simpson thing. I mean, I feel like obviously she's not a virgin anymore, and it kind of depresses me that I know that at all. But, you know, she was like the ultimate pop culture, like, oh, she's so wonderful and she's saving herself for marriage. And her father was always played this like really big role in her image and her, you know, in her, in particular, her image as a virgin. And she did the whole purity pledge to her dad and that whole thing. And I don't know, it was kind of an amazing thing to watch. And now I guess she's a slut just like the rest of us. I don't know.
I think that she is.
Well, she's divorced, right? So she has to be.
And has dated like a bunch of famous dudes. So there you go.
That's right.
So movies and books are obviously very different formats.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they each have their strengths. What areas do you feel that the movie was able to do things that the book wasn't able to do?
That's a really good question. You know, I think what was really great about making this a film was kind of being able to show and not just tell, you know, the pop culture examples. You can talk about stuff that lawmakers have said, but until you hear the particular kind of disgusting paternalistic tone that it comes with, it really doesn't make the same impression, you know, like to actually hear these ridiculous words come out of people's mouths is a whole other story. And I think, you know, what's really fantastic in terms of kind of reaching out to more people and getting this message out there, particularly for younger folks, is that having current examples from pop culture is just a really effective tool to talking about these issues, which sometimes people see, you know, you talk about like the virgin whore dichotomy and all of this sort of stuff, and people see these issues as maybe overly academic. So having an entry point for conversation that's a little bit more accessible, I think is really important.
So in the years since you've written the book and while you are working on this particular movie, the purity myth, I think, has gone through some changes and permutations in our our culture. What have you seen? How do you feel that it's gotten since you've really kind of laid this argument out?
You know, it's changed a bunch. I mean, obviously, I think the biggest change between when the book published and now is the change in administration and the funding for abstinence-only education. You know, we don't have the same kind of funding, thank God, that we did before. But I think a lot of people think that because Obama is in office now, abstinence-only education has kind of gone away, and it really hasn't at all. You know, if you look at kind of state-level curricula, if you look at, you know, what's going on in your community, abstinence-only education is still going very strong. What has changed in terms of the movement that surrounds it and promotes abstinence-only education is that they've gotten a lot smarter about the way that they frame their message. They realize now, I think, that people consider them a little bit bizarre and kooky, and that, you know, they had these like comedians who used to dangle bricks over kids' crotches and just being like so radical. I think that they realize that they've turned a lot of people off. And obviously study after study keeps coming out saying that it was a complete public health failure and, you know, inaccurate and ridiculous and doesn't stop kids from having sex. So they're trying to kind of reframe their message and come out as more serious. They're renaming their organizations to things, you know, like medical education this and whatever that, to sound much more credible. And so in that way, I think that they've become more dangerous. And they're also kind of riled up, you know, in the same way that progressives and feminists were really riled up in opposition to the Bush administration. I think the same thing is happening now. But in terms of pop culture, I don't think that much has changed.
So one last question. It seems to me that with the kind of fall of abstinence only, we're seeing more of the purity myth energies shifted towards like actually trying to cut off access to things like the HPV vaccine and emergency contraception. Do you have thoughts about on how this played out with the Obama administration of all people falling into the trap of upholding Plan B restrictions?
I think it's totally disgusting. I mean, you know, it's really difficult. And as a feminist who, you know, supported Obama and kind of talked myself into a lot of like, okay, you have to make concessions, it's all good, to see them make this concession was just so horrifying. You know, to completely ignore science experts, you know, just, you know, any kind of accepted knowledge on Plan B, and to invoke being a father as part of the reason why, you know, why this happened, I think was particularly galling for me. So yeah, it has not been a happy time.
Yeah. As soon as he said as the father of two daughters, I thought of you.
Yeah. I mean, I'm like, take him to a purity ball then. I mean, it's just totally out of line. And the other thing, I mean, I'm thinking a lot about that I didn't mention in your last question is, you know, even if abstinence only education goes completely away and we're successful kind of on a community level, on a school level of completely eradicating it, we have this problem of now having an entire generation of young people who have been lied to about sexual health. And what do we do with that now, right? Like, how do we re-educate this generation of people who have been fed a bunch of bullshit about what sexuality is, about, you know, sexual health, you know, and really at the end of the day, I feel like their human rights were violated when they were given incorrect information. So I think we also have to start thinking about, you know, what can we do to undo the damage that's been done?
My guest today has been Jessica Valenti. Her movie is called The Purity Myth, and it was made by the Media Education Foundation. It's up for sale at mediaed.org. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Jessica.
Thanks for having me.
Now that Michelle Bachmann is out of the race, I'm beginning to feel like I'm going to miss her. Sure, there were plenty of times that I disagreed with her, often vehemently. But she added a little something to the GOP primary campaign. Something short. Something Midwestern. Something female. Now it's the usual bunch of dudes up there, and I feel that something's lost. But I think this is a good time to go over the long list of Bachmann's greatest hits when it comes to comments about gender and sexuality. We've already reviewed her claims that the HPV vaccine could cause mental retardation. But let's face it, that barely scratched the surface. A recent favorite of mine had Bachmann sharing her views on the rights of young women in her own household to pick up the phone and call boys.
And well, the first girl, my first girlfriend was Jennifer Mallets.
In my time, girls didn't ask boys to prom.
Yeah, well, let me tell you.
If you were,
I have a 13-year-old son. Those days have changed big time.
Well, and our girls are not allowed to do that in our house. They have to wait for the boy to call.
Since kids haven't done the whole formal, may I ask you on a date thing in roughly 30 years, if not longer, restricting girls from asking boys out doubly makes no sense. Most asking out teenagers do is informal. The only way to enforce that rule is to never let girls make a move in a boy's direction ever, for fear that that seems forward. Sitting by the phone waiting for someone to magically call you with no effort on your behalf is not known to work in the modern era. I wish I could get an honest assessment from her girls on how the system is working out for them. Bachmann's idea that young women's sexuality is scary and should be controlled is, well, something of an obsession of hers. Thus, her scorched earth campaign against the HPV vaccine. Not only did she claim it causes mental retardation, but she found many other occasions to suggest that the vaccine was some kind of blight on humanity.
Michelle Bachmann's in Sheldon, Iowa. And a woman by the name of Julie Weppel is going to ask her about her daughter, Jessica. And Ms. Weppel says that, hey, her daughter took the vaccine that Bachmann has been criticizing Rick Perry for authorizing in Texas and saying that all the kids should take it, and that it caused headaches, pains, and seizures for her daughter for at least 3 years. And so Bachmann's going to agree. And part of her response, she says, it's Jessica who's having to have her body live with the ravages of this vaccine.
There is literally no evidence for this supposed ravaging. Now, cervical cancer does, in fact, ravage your body, especially if you don't catch it early. Meanwhile, Bachman doesn't lose it over other vaccines, which are equally dangerous to Gardasil, which is to say, not very much at all. Why the double standard? Well, it's obvious. The ravages Bachman is alluding to is this perverse right-wing theory that by giving the vaccine to young women, they're going to feel compelled to start going out and having sex. The only part of the body that Bachman seems worried will get ravaged, in other words, is the hymen. Nothing else seems to matter. Certainly not the cervix or the body attached to it. Okay, so I won't miss Bachman's scaremongering about the HPV vaccine very much, but I will kind of miss her bloviating about abortion.
Our American landscape has changed so dramatically over these last 31 years. I was in high school when the Roe versus Wade decision came down. I hate to admit, I was so ignorant when I was a junior in high school. I didn't even know what abortion meant. I didn't even know what it was. What innocence that time was in the early 70s here in the United States.
It takes a special kind of person to claim they didn't know what abortion was before Roe versus Wade, and then to conclude that they, in their intense ignorance, are somehow an expert on it. It takes someone even more special to pretend that legalizing abortion somehow made it come into being. How would the court have known what abortion was if it didn't exist before 1973? We don't know. We just know that Bachman is very, very sure of herself and will not let anything like ignorance get in the way of that assurance. And for that, we will miss her on the campaign trail very much. And now for the wisdom of wingnuts. Limbaugh lays it all out for you. Rush Limbaugh basically admitted on a recent episode that supposedly small government conservatives do want government to be big enough to fit into your uterus.
Conservatives actually do like a big government. For example, conservatives do want an activist government defending what's right and attacking what's wrong. Big government may not be the term, but, for example, conservatives do think that it's the role of government to protect the sanctity of life.
Well, obviously it's not the sanctity of life, or they wouldn't be the first to rattle the sabers when the war cry was sent out. Sanctity of male dominance would be a better measure of that. They're against government when it protects women's rights, and for it when it takes them away. He's right. That is pretty simple when you think about it.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.